It wasn't a debate. It was a smackdown on one candidate. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principles and Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaels.
Hey, Barry. It's good to be back with you here in my studio and you in your studio. So we're doing another magic of Skype recording. So if you hear funny noises, don't sweat it.
No, that's true. And Chuck, we're recording today, and it's kind of a special day, not just because it's the day after the latest Republican candidate primary debate, but because that today is November the 11th of 2015, and we all recognize that as, well, Veterans Day, but it was also called Armistice Day. And Chuck, it was November the 11th at 11:11 a.m. is
no,
my understanding.
It's the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month.
Hour at 11 o'clock, yes. So 11th hour of the 11th day of that. So
right. This is the day that World War One ended. It was an armistice, and of course the treaty was not signed until 1919, and we all know what happened as a direct result or an indirect result of signing that treaty, which was frankly awful. There's a good book out there if you want to know more about World War One and the horrible mistakes that were made and in ending it. And how it led to other things, including things that we are dealing with today. There's a good book called Illusion of Victory by Thomas Fleming. And I see copies of it over at Half Price Books from time to time. There's an advertisement, an unsolicited advertisement for Half Price Books, for which a huge amount of my library has come from. But it's a good book, very good book, a very entertaining read and a very informative read. So I would suggest people read that because he pulls no punches on who the guilty parties were and who basically went into the thing completely naive and came out and essentially destroyed themselves trying to get certain things done, namely Woodrow Wilson. Very interesting book.
Absolutely. And, you know, as far as it goes, oftentimes when we go into war and we end wars, it says that we may have won the war but lost the peace. And I think that that's, you know, that's been somewhat endemic for a while with foreign policy issues. And I think that's maybe part of the reason why you're seeing so many of the Republican candidates now, you know, starting to pay a little bit more attention, I think, Chuck, to foreign policy issues. And last night's debate actually kind of encapsulated a little bit of that between a couple of the contenders on the main stage. Now, this time, Chuck, the Fox Business Network debate in Milwaukee was a little bit different because of the different makeup that we've seen from the first debates. This time, the undercard had a little bit of a different look to it. The undercard, the early debate, which are the candidates who are polling above a certain point, of I think above 1%, but below the 3 or 4% cutoff, I think it was 3%, that Fox Business Network had for the main stage, were on display, and there were four, and it wasn't the four that had been there before. At least only two of them had been there, and two of them had been disinvited. Now, the two disinvitees were George Pataki, the former governor of New York, and Lindsey Graham of South Carolina. And Chuck, I can just say it's about time.
Yeah, yeah, no kidding, no kidding.
We're disinvited to the entire party because, frankly, neither one of them has a legitimate I won't even say shot at winning the nomination, but they don't even have a legitimate platform to run for the nomination.
I have to laugh, though, Barry. To talk about an ego, Lindsey Graham, a couple of weeks ago, basically came out and in an interview and said, "I don't understand how I'm losing to these losers." That's a paraphrase. It's not a... So essentially, Graham just showed himself to be an egomaniac with zero support. Nobody is supporting Lindsey Graham. Nobody. I would be shocked if he had 5% support in his home state. I have not seen a poll, but Lindsey Graham is not going to. Lindsey Graham's not going to be here during the serious part of the campaign.
No, he's not, Jeff. You're absolutely right in that. I think that Graham is basically. We're getting toward Christmas, and I think the Christmas present that the a lot of the folks on the main stage are hoping for are the dropouts of a number of the folks on the second stage.
So, well, yeah.
And I think Lindsey Graham could help that by being one of the first to drop out of this race because, frankly, Lindsey Graham is not helping himself at all, and he is not doing anything in order to help the Republican Party at all. He's just running his own particularly angry form of moderate to liberal politics that, for some reason, kept getting him elected in South Carolina. I still, to this day, I'm still marveling at the fact that Lindsey Graham is the senator for South Carolina, given how conservative South Carolina is as a state overall.
Well, I'm not, and I'll tell you why. Once the Republican machine gets an establishment candidate in, they will do anything to keep them in. They will run character assassination campaigns on conservative challengers. They will blackmail people with threats of you'll never get another contract again if you support this person and he wins. There are all kinds of tactics that get used with these political machines to make certain that these candidates continue to thrive. This is how Mitch McConnell keeps getting elected in Kentucky. Kentucky's Mitch McConnell is a seasoned arm twister and a seasoned veteran of the conservative versus the moderate wars. And we all know that Mitch McConnell is a moderate, and look, it's very telling about what's going on in the GOP if these guys stay in, if Lindsey Graham stays in, if George Pataki stays in, and I have an idea Pataki's essentially all but out.
Certainly, yes.
But if these guys stay in, it says a lot because what it is, it's part of Karl Rove's strategy. And this is well known. This is not something I've come up with and dreamed up myself and come up with this great, you know, theory that is cockamamie scheme. This is Karl Rove's way of making sure that GOP establishment candidates stay in control of the party. And that is what they do is they split up that vote. They split That's up true. That vote. They run as many GOP establishment candidates as they can. Think John Kasich. Think Marco Rubio. Think Jeb Bush. The list goes on and on. And what they do is at convention time, you end up with a brokered convention. In other words, you've got a leader. And the big plan originally, you can see it, you know, the quote-unquote anointed candidate was Jeb Bush. And the idea was that he would have the most delegates, but not enough for a nomination. And then they would get together with all the minor candidates who had way fewer delegates. And most of them would be GOPE candidates, and then they would broker who would be vice president to get the over-the-top delegates. They'd promise secretary of state or secretary, you know, different cabinet posts. And you don't think John Kasich isn't angling for a cabinet post? Oh, you bet he is.
Of course he is.
And I have an idea he'd like to be, for instance, commerce secretary. Although I think he sees himself in the secretary of state position. Oh, my gosh. John Kasich as Secretary of State.
I think his debate presence in the last couple of debates will put an end to that belief.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we'll talk about that a little bit more as we go here. But, yeah, basically, you know, what we had was there's been an attempt, obviously, to broker or rig the Republican primaries in order to get favorite sons category status for people like Jeb Bush. And now we see that Rove addressed on that situation is now moving over toward a different candidate. That would be one Marco Rubio. He seems to be the next in line for the moderate wing of the party's stalking horse. When Jeb was showing a lack of ability to get the numbers moving and a lack of ability to build any excitement for his moderate positions, now Marco Rubio is starting to arise. And, of course, one of the things that hat tips that Marco Rubio is one of the establishment's results or answers is that it was just announced this last week, Charles, that he'd picked up a significant donor supporter for his campaign. And that person's name is not unfamiliar to any of our listeners who paid any attention to us as we scream and yell about this from time to time. The backer is one Paul Singer. Paul Singer, who is a billionaire hedge fund manager out of New York, who was one of the key primary donor drivers of the Romney presidential run, and was one of the chief backers of both Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan, has now come out and has thrown his weight and has started throwing his donations behind Marco Rubio.
Well, that should surprise no one. And I believe, where's Sheldon Adelson in this?
Adelson has been strangely quiet, but you have to remember that there is another debate that is scheduled in Nevada here shortly, I think in December. So Adelson will have a play in the machinations here shortly around the time of the Nevada debates.
Okay. Well, I'm going to just about tell you, I'm going to make a prediction. Sheldon Adelson will come out for Marco Rubio.
Most likely. Most likely, because they're, like I said, they're all lining up behind the one candidate, because they're now deciding that, well, first of all, and again, last night's performance was a factor, that another candidate who has been parading around as a moderate from a conservative state, it just isn't ready for prime time and is losing support rapidly, and that is Ohio's own John Kasich.
To say the least, Kasich is doing what we expected, honestly, that what we expected him to do. He's basically, there's an old saying from the 60s. And since we're really in the middle of a 60s redo right now, honestly, with we're gearing up for campus violence and race riots and all the stuff that we had in the 60s, for those of you who were too young to remember, there us oldsters were lived through it and remember very well what the lead ups were. What's going on here is there was an old saying in 1968 or 69, actually, after Richard Nixon took office, and he was chided for not being too involved in domestic policy. Nixon was a foreign policy wonk. And basically, the idea was that someone else would take over running the internal policy stuff and let Nixon be Nixon. Do you remember that saying?
Yes, I remember that phrase. Nixon be Nixon.
Let Nixon be Nixon. And so what we're having is, unfortunately, we're letting Kasich be Kasich. Kasich is basically out there showing what he's really truly made of. And unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, this is it. This is what John Kasich is made of.
It's snakes and snails and puppy dog tails. Right?
Well, yeah.
More emphasis on the snake than the snail.
Yeah.
Or the puppy dog.
Vipers, if you will. Yeah.
Well, Chuck, it's really telling. And for those of you who did not watch the debates last night, well, congratulations to you for not wasting your time. For those of you who didn't watch the debates last night, the post-debate analysis across the spectrum, Charles, not only from the hardcore conservatives at places like Red State and others, but also from, you know, Fox Business Network itself, Breitbart, Vox, of all places, even liberal organizations, really had an issue with John Kasich. And the fact that to a person, they described John Kasich's debate performance last night as irritating, arrogant, bullish. The list of pejoratives goes on and on and on. And for those of you who pay any attention to this over at The Blaze, Glenn Beck has named the new category Epic Loser for John Kasich's performance last night. And this is Glenn Beck, who has not necessarily been a critic of John Kasich during his run. As a matter of fact, you know, Beck has been rather nice to John Kasich during most of this, unlike people like Eric Erickson over at Red State or the guys over at Watchdog, who I think revel in taking shots at the Ohio governor. But, you know, Glenn Beck has now finally said, you know, he goes, we're looking a little bit more, and he thinks that, the winners in the debate were, you know, Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. You know, and that Carly had a good night, and that, you know, kind of Rand Paul did okay. He thought a loser, the big loser, obviously, was Jeb Bush. And, you know, for his respect, and, you know, there's a little bit of personal animosity here, I think, and that is with Donald Trump. He doesn't like Donald Trump either.
Well, if you notice, this article, he basically doesn't mention Trump at all, and I'll tell you why. He's getting slapped around on his own site.
Yes.
He's getting slapped around hard because he doesn't like Trump. Well, okay. Unfortunately, let's just say that Glenn Beck is, to put it kindly, chimeric.
Yes.
And if to explain what that word means, a chimera, it's a mythical animal that has the parts of different creatures.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn Beck is all over the place. You never know what's going to come out of him. I mean, he's strange on immigration. He's strange on a number of things, and it goes beyond his the Mormonism thing. But he really doesn't like Trump. I understand kind of why, and it has to do with the fact that he doesn't really view Trump as actually a conservative, and the fact is he's not. Trump knows how to say the right things to the right people because he is a master negotiator. If you can say anything about Donald Trump, he is a master negotiator.
Well, true. But that isn't necessarily a discounting factor for him being in the most powerful office in the world, Chuck.
No, it's not.
Presidency, as they like to call it. Although we know that really in modern American government parlance, really the most powerful office in the world right now seems to be the swing vote on the Supreme Court. But as it may, you know, what we're really dealing down with here is the fact that, you know, yeah, Beck doesn't like Trump, but Trump did pretty well last night. At least he kept to his own. He didn't lose. But on Glenn Beck's website on The Blaze this morning, he says that, you know, he's created a new category in his analysis called Epic Loser.
Epic
and that's
Loser,
all
yeah.
Capital letters. and he basically said, Epic Loser, John Kasich. And here's the analysis. Just bad on every front, epically bad, looked rude, old, desperate, cheap, and wildly wrong on many fronts. That was a suicide mission on himself. No presidency, no vice presidency, and no virgins. So we now know what Glenn Beck thinks about John Kasich, so we can add him to the list of those who are lining up to help conservatives in America understand the reality behind John Kasich's illusionary aura that he's trying to build around himself with his media and his messaging. But, you know, even so, you know, if you think about this, all of the candidates in the top card last night, and you know what, we never did get to finishing the undercard. The four undercard debaters were, of course, Rick Santorum, who's always been on the undercard.
Yes.
Bobby Jindal, who has always been on the undercard, but I think myself, Chuck, I'm like really disappointed in that because I do believe that Bobby Jindal is probably one of the strongest candidates out there on policy issues and experience who can't get a break.
A dream ticket from the existing candidates would be, for me, Cruz Jindal.
Yeah, well, me too, as well. Or vice versa, Jindal Cruz. I think
either way
would work really well.
Either way. Yeah,
most people seem to think Bobby Jindal won the undercard debate, except for those who are still hanging on to the illusion of the establishment controlling both ends of the debate. And so, therefore, they want to go and pick one, the the second person who ended up dropping from the top card down to the undercard, and that's Chris Christie. And basically all Christie did during the undercard debate was make it about Hillary, which, you know, that's red meat for a lot of people who, you know, are worried more about who the Democrats are putting up rather than worrying about who they might put up as Republicans to, you know, serve the nation and have their finger on the trigger and, you know, negotiate with all of the powers and the crazies of the world. I'm not a big fan of Chris Christie. The establishment seems to like him a lot. So I have a little problem with when I see establishment sources talking about how Chris Christie won the undercard debate.
Yeah, right.
Honestly, Jindal cleaned the floor with him.
Well, here's the deal, Barry. It looks to me like essentially Chris Christie is being held on injured reserve in case yes. something happens to Rubio. Because I think like we've said before, I think Jeb is done. Kasich looked like the guy that the GOP establishment was going to go to, but he has an automatic weapon that he has pointed at his foot that he can't seem to stop and take his finger off the trigger. So is a so over the top on his debate performance that you know he's going nowhere. So I think really Chris Christie is. On injured reserve in this undercard thing. I think that if it becomes necessary, they'll call him up.
Well, that's probably true. That's probably the reason why he got bumped to the undercard, Chuck. However, you know, when we're looking at it, you're looking at this whole thing. Christie's record in New Jersey is atrocious.
Yeah. It's awful.
He originally ran as a Tea Party guy, but then showed that he was an establishment moderate as soon as he got into office, which isn't surprising because, sadly enough, in the early days of the Tea Party movement, many candidates were being put up who sounded great, but once they took office, ended up not being so great.
Well, what else is new, Barry? Basically, what you've got, the Tea Party was a group of people who were angry with the way things were. All you had to do to sell yourself was make yourself appear as a conservative and say the right things to the group. One thing you can say about the Tea Party, they've learned pretty fast.
Yes, they are catching on much quicker than they used to. That's for sure.
And they're not putting up with all this nonsense. People come in and say one thing and their record says another. They're being called out on it now because there are people inside the movement. They've broomed out a lot of the people. If you recall, there was a guy down in Tennessee who claimed he was one of the guys who started the Tea Party, and he was all mad. Well, it turned out that this guy was a GOP establishment guy. And I cannot remember his name. Do you know who I'm talking about? We did a show on this, I don't know, a year ago, maybe 18 months ago, about this fellow who was quite angry about what was going on in the Tea Party because it was being hijacked by the crazies, he said. Well, that's GOP speak for people who are actually conservative and believe the Constitution says what it says and it should be obeyed.
There were two people you might be talking about. Michael Gerson is one of them, but he's not. It was Judson Phillips.
Judson Phillips. I'm almost sure that was him.
Yeah, Judson Phillips, who was one of the founders of the Tea Party, who is still out there, still, you know, talking up a lot that, the Tea Party is great, but it's being hijacked.
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly the person I'm talking to. And he wrote a couple of big articles. They got, you know, when people were attempting to pull the pall over the face of the Tea Party and say it's dead movement, a lot of his stuff was getting run. Now that it's risen from the, you know, like the phoenix has risen from the flames, and brought us Carson and Trump, that kind of stuff has gone by the wayside. Nobody's listening at the moment. Guys like him will be back in the news as soon as the GOP manages to wrest the nomination away from the person who actually earned it and give it to a GOPE candidate. Because you and I both know that's exactly what's going to happen. The real question is, what will that do to the party? And honestly, I think that splits the Republican Party fatally.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. You're right. I just want to take a second here, though, and point out this is something that Judson Phillips said in his analysis of the elections last week. You know, he was going down and talking about how the Tea Party is getting hijacked and things of that. And then he goes into Kentucky and he says, for those whose only source of information was the drive-by media, you notice how he's using the phrasing to make it sound like he's a Tea Partier.
Yeah.
They might believe that Matt Bevin was the Tea Party candidate. Bevin was supported by one local Tea Party group and some Washington-based groups that came in and anointed him as the Tea Party candidate. Two national groups, Tea Party Nation and the TeaParty.net, endorsed Mitch McConnell, and the Tea Party Express did not become involved in that race. So with the Tea Party movement at best fractured in Kentucky, how did Matt Bevin become the Tea Party candidate? The answer is, he never was the Tea Party candidate. Kentucky voters rejected him by a 2-1 margin in the primary. So this is going back talking about the primary.
Yeah.
Actually, so, I'm sorry, article was not from Tuesday's election. This was from like last cycle's
2012. I think that's 2012.
2014. And he says, Bevin was the candidate of Washington-based consultants who want to control the Tea Party for their own purposes. Now, stop me if I'm wrong, Chuck, but isn't that a classic misdirect? Because he's basically now saying that Tea Party Nation and TeaParty.net endorsed Mitch McConnell. Wouldn't it be that those were Washington-based groups who are trying to riot a candidate who's a moderate and not a Tea Partier? For their own purposes, and I think Kentucky voters saw through that. They didn't see through it in the primary because they didn't know Bevin well enough, but Bevin's primary against Mitch McConnell was strong enough to allow him to then utilize it as a springboard with the help of the Tea Party of Kentucky. As a matter of fact, his lieutenant governor now, it was the president of the Bowling Green Area Tea Party down in southern Kentucky, and who's also the first African-American woman to be elected to a statewide office in Kentucky in history.
Barry, it's embarrassing that guys like this are out there. Now, I think he was Tea Party Nation.
Yes.
Is Tea Party Nation.
Yes.
And
yes,
Tea Party Nation is ignored by the vast majority of the Tea Party because it's too establishment.
Exactly.
And this idea that Bevin was the lackey of Washington consulting firms?
It is hilarious.
This is beyond propaganda. I mean, this is Soviet-style propaganda.
Well, this is recreating things in a way that helps you to create your own meme, Chuck. I mean, that's really what we're getting down to is we'll ignore actual, you know, fact and just create our own meme out of it. How about that? Why don't we just do it that way?
Yeah, I mean, it's just if you can't succeed by telling the truth and you can't succeed by telling a small lie, make it big. Make it really big. Yeah, just make it like a giant Godzilla of a lie. And on the sheer fact that people go, oh, my gosh, that some of them will believe it.
Sadly enough, that's true.
What that particular part of people who are basically horning in on the Tea Party movement think, who cares? This is the GOP establishment's attempt to hijack the Tea Party. And if you'll recall, when the whole movement started, we said it'll be dead soon because it'll get hijacked. Well, guess what? We were wrong, or at least I was. I don't know. I'm not going to speak for you. I was wrong. It's not dead. And the attempts to hijack it were strong, and they're still out there. However, basically nobody bought in, which speaks highly of the Tea Party movement to me.
Yes, it does.
You know, they're like, no, you know, they really are. And, you know, you and I talked about this off air about some things that you saw in meetings. There really are the people out there who are seriously Charlie Brown to Lucy.
Yes, they are.
Because Lucy holds that football and tempts him, poor old Charlie Brown, every time. And the scenarios get longer and longer. He says, no, I'm not going to try to kick it. And she's like, look, and she'll talk him. She'll come up with any reason why it's impossible for her to pull the ball away. And at the last minute, she always pulls the ball away. Who is Lucy? Yeah. Arg. is the Charles Schultz. Og. Who is Lucy? Lucy is the GOP establishment. We swear, give us this candidate, and we'll give in to your wishes. We'll get him to do what he should do, what you want him to do, and we'll give you your candidate next time. Does next time ever come? Okay. One of my favorite places to eat that I can't afford to eat at is Joe's Crab Shack. What's one of the mottos on the side of the building?
I think it's free crab tomorrow, right?
Free crab tomorrow. Every day it says free crab tomorrow. Bingo. That's exactly, that's the GOP establishment. Free candidates tomorrow.
Your candidates tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah. Conservative candidates tomorrow.
Sit down and be quiet now and vote for us so we can get into office so we can change things for the better for you so that you can have all these great things that you want, like, you know, ending of amnesty, ending of illegal aliens coming across the border, protection of your gun rights, and yes, we are going to get rid of abortion in this country. Of course, that's what they say during the campaign. What happens during the governing is an entirely different matter most of the time.
Well, you know, I have said, and I will continue to say, that the GOP had big plans to bury all the social activism with this election. They were going to make basically all the anti-abortion people go away. They're just by ignoring them, because they were going to come out so strong because of Obama that they were going to be able to ignore LGBT stuff. They were going to be able to ignore abortion. They were going to be able to ignore all these things, because after all, those weren't really important. What was important was economics.
Yes.
And what do we find out? Here they got the golden opportunity to make the base happy in their lap, and what have they done with it? Squandered. Not only
I was just about to say squandered it.
It's beyond squandered, Barry. They're attempting to squelch it, and the problem is that the voice is a little too loud. I mean, when you've got Planned Parenthood admitting that they're harvesting and selling parts of infants. And not only are they doing it, but they're doing it in a callous fashion. They're basically doing essentially almost the same thing that we hear about coming out of death camps, where people are making lampshades out of human skin and that kind of thing. It's not all that different than the things we saw in those videos. What is the GOP doing with it? They're vacillating on ending support for Planned Parenthood because of all the quote-unquote good other work, you know, other diagnostic work they're doing. When it turns out all that diagnostic work is being farmed out to other places where the women could have gone in the first place. This is sad.
No, of course, absolutely.
Not only that, the GOP was going to chuck LGBT and gay marriage and all that stuff because it was quote unquote divisive. Well, guess what, folks? The divide is here. What's the GOP doing with it? Nothing. They're not working to get anything done on it. In fact, they want to let it happen. Well, it's Supreme Court decision, law of the land, we got to deal with it, all that stuff. How's that working out?
Not so much.
The base is unhappy with that. That is why you're seeing Trump, who I'm pretty sure is not exactly anti-gay marriage, and Carson, who honestly is an enigma on a whole bunch of his agenda, are out in front. And the reason Carson's out front is because he's a man of faith. There's no doubt about that. He's a man of strong faith. Mm-hmm. That's getting him a lot of the Christian vote, which really wasn't supposed to be worth much. We can get rid of that and still win. What's the GOP finding out? No, you can't get rid of that and still win. They should have known that already, because that's what happened with McCain. Basically, a bunch of the Christian conservatives said, we're not going to vote for him. A lot of people sat home in both 2014 and 2010, and you know, all the presidential elections. They sat home because the GOP was fielding lousy candidates.
Absolutely. Well, you know, and I think you'd be happy to know that according to many analyses, and it depends because, you know, some are saying Cruz and some are saying Rubio, but many are saying that Ben Carson did actually win the debate on Tuesday night, that he was the overall winner, that he defended his record, he gave substantive answers on policy issues. Chuck, that's what I've been waiting on now for a while.
Yes.
Is to get past all the stupid... you know, let's make an issue out of how many times you've said this guy's nose is too big or this other guy's hair is funny, and let's get down to discussing policy issues, because I figured, and I think I've said this before, is once we get to talking policy, that's going to separate the field. You're going to see the solid candidates versus the ones who just aren't ready for prime time, and I think that's what happened here, because Carson, very strong on economics and foreign policy. Donald Trump, because, and you said it, he is the negotiator in the room. So obviously trade and policy, foreign policy issues are pretty strong for him. And it showed in the debate. Rand Paul really did really well, but what he did was he went after Marco Rubio, and kind of attacked him on places where they differ on military spending and other areas of, you know, civil liberties protections, where Rubio has voted obviously most of the time with the establishment, and Senator Paul has voted most of the time as a more of a libertarian and a civil liberties supporter. So they had an interesting. It was really good to actually see them not talking about whether Marco Rubio's 15-year-old. Check receipts, you know, are all added up to the penny, or, you know, talk about or for somebody to talk about Rand Paul's father and like they're debating him. I think that was good there, because we really did have some substantive discussions about deep philosophical and governing philosophies, especially between two members of the United States Senate, both of whom are very significant in their own spheres inside that body. And of course, we can't leave out another U.S. Senator, Ted Cruz, who really did a fantastic job of coming out and, you know, making a good, solid defense of positions, discussing some key issues like the IRS, our immigration problem, and other things. And so Ted Cruz had a good night, too. So really, that was pretty much like the A tier. So if you had to separate that first stage out, and as you remember, there were nine people on the top stage, and four on the bottom stage this time. So basically, those five, Carson, Trump, Cruz, Paul, and Rubio, all really did a fantastic job. Carly Fiorina, I guess if you really wanted to say she did pretty well, she held her own. She didn't gain anything in this debate. I'm not sure she lost anything either. But, you know, the ones who really, I think, did stand to lose something here, Marco Rubio lost by virtue of not winning.
Yeah.
That's the whole point. You know, with the momentum coming to him from the establishment, with the fact that now he's going to be the propped up, golden boy for everything that they want to do, for him to get basically lower part of the top third in this debate, and it's top 40%. Let's not say the top third because he wasn't in the top three. That was a loss for him. He rankly really just didn't come over well, and Rand Paul showed that he could out-debate him. So I think that Rubio didn't help himself. I'm not sure that he actually hurt himself among his base constituency, because, again, that's the moneyed establishment interest, and I think they were fine. Now, the two people who did hurt themselves with that base, obviously Jeb Bush, who, frankly, Chuck, if he's around during after the first filing in the middle of December, I'll be surprised, because I'm sure that those big money handlers will be saying, you need to get out of here so that we can clear the field
for Rubio. Yeah, we need to clear the field for Rubio, yeah.
And John Kasich, who not only basically, as Beck said, was an epic loser in this debate, but actually could have even hurt himself back home in his own state. I saw a piece after the debate last night. The pollster that the Republican Party tends to use a lot is a gentleman by the name of Frank Lutz. And whether you really like Frank or not is beside the point. What he has made a cottage industry out of is doing live focus groups during issues, like during debates like this. And so Lutz picked his focus group and got them all together there in Milwaukee, and they were watching the debate live. And of course, he uses all kinds of interesting technological gizmos like galvanic skin response monitors and
e-meters,
things that monitor your pupil dilation, you know, and your skin response as to whether or not you like or dislike something. And he also has these dialometers where they can sit there with their hand on a dial and they can turn it higher if they like something and turn it lower if they dislike a comment from a candidate. Well, he said that John Kasich scored the lowest of any candidate he's ever scored in a focus group with his debate performance last night. I think on a couple of points, especially one on bailing out banks, which John Kasich is absolutely, you know, defending to the teeth,
yeah,
of providing bailouts to banking interests, he scored an 8, Chuck. An 8, I think it's maybe a 100-point scale.
Yeah, he got an 8.
He got an 8, which I think is probably going to serve to even lower his percentages in his own home state of Ohio, which right now, you know, during the latest polling, John Kasich isn't even winning Ohio as a primary candidate. He's coming in third behind Trump and Carson. My guess is that he's probably going to end up, if he does continue this quixotic run, he's going to end up probably in fourth place in Ohio in the primary. Now, you know, yes, the party will be out there stumping hard, and
sure,
Johnny's our man, and all the way Johnny, and all that good stuff. But I think the base voters are getting sick of him. They're starting to understand who the real John Kasich is. Yeah, I mean, Chuck, I'm sorry, when you say that Roe v. Wade is the law of the land, that gay marriage, we just have to accept it, you want to bail out the banks, and you're okay with open borders and amnesty, you're basically showing that you should be running in the Democratic Party primary, not the Republican Party primary.
Well, the whole argument with the bailing the banks out was that people would lose their deposits. Barry, that never happens in a bank failure.
That never happens. No, usually banks, if they're in trouble or they have to close, there's a lot of things that happen. Hey, because we have banking reform laws that have taken place, customers have to get notified. This isn't like the 1920s all over again,
right,
or the George Bailey universe, you know, when Mr. Potter shuts the bank down for a bank holiday. And we're not Europe either. We don't do bank holidays around here. If a bank is becoming insolvent, bank regulators come in, they address it. If they can't fix it, then they send out notices to all the depositors that the bank is getting ready to close, and help them shift deposits to another financial institution.
Well, or basically what happens is the assets pass immediately to a rescue bank.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
And business as usual. Now, is that the right system? No, it's not the right system. But that's the system we got. And this thing about John Kasich coming in to bail out Bank of America, I'm sorry, Bank of America had no business being bailed out. They should have failed. Anybody who engages in the economic policies that Bank of America engaged in deserves to fail. So,
well, but that's the whole point is John Kasich has said that he wants to continue on this new tradition of picking winners and losers via the government. In other words, he's carved out a purely economic socialist position.
Yeah, exactly. And we, Barry, we've been saying that now. I remember when he ran originally, and we said, this is what you're going to get. And people were like, that can't be. He's a true conservative. He showed it by balancing the budget, which he never did. And by the way, that canard keeps popping up. He should be a policy wonk on economics because, you know, he helped balance the budget in the mid-90s. The budget was not balanced in the mid-1990s. John Kasich learned the tricks of the trade that he utilizes to this day, and that is to kick debt down the road, to hide it, to put it out in long-term bonds, so that basically your grandkids get to pay these huge deficits with interest. I mean, that's how we got where we are. And also taking Social Security, bringing the money into the general fund and then taking the expenses off the books. I'm sorry, that's not a balanced budget. That's like taking my credit, you know, making sure that my credit cards don't show on my financial statement. Sorry, that doesn't work. You can't push debt down the road and make it look like your budget is balanced.
No, absolutely not. But you know what? And whether or not, and you also can't balance a budget by borrowing or expecting on free money to keep flowing in. And so you use that money to expand a service in your state and then transfer the money that you don't have to use in the state coffers over to cover holes in the other parts of the state budget.
And that's what we did with the $7 billion hole.
Right. And Medicaid expansion. Well, you know, we did that. Some of that we did with, you know, shutting down some things and some changes. And but vast majority of the problem is now, if you take a look and you can go over to the Ohio Treasurer's website, they have the online checkbook, Chuck, at the Ohio Treasurer's office. And you can go over there and see clearly that, yes, our state spending went down in the year between Ted Strickland and John Kasich, but it has been growing every year since under the Kasich administration, to the point where the last two fiscal years we are spending more money than Ted Strickland spent in his highest year of spending in office with no end in sight.
Yeah, and basically he ran on fiscal conservatism.
Absolutely. As a matter of fact, you know, and he ran on fiscal conservatism, but he governed on going to the Obama administration and accepting billions of dollars in Medicaid expansion money, which to almost any analysis now after the first year of implementation is starting to show that they woefully underestimated the number of new clients that would be eligible for and receive Medicaid. It's outpacing at almost a 50% rate.
Well,
so and given the fact that the R money, as John Kasich called it, that was coming from the Obama administration's expansion of the debt ceiling, and you know what? In one sense, I'll give John Kasich a hat tip. It is R money. Problem is, it's our money that's being taken out of my pocket for taxes, left, right, and center, and then is being funneled by the federal government back to you at the state government to go redistribute it to everybody else, and I end up paying the bills.
And this is what you get from a candidate like Kasich. Now, he's not the only one, but he's the most blatant. I guess we should be thankful that he's there for actually – he's the most upfront about his socialism. In other words – it's like what he's saying is that I'm stealing this money for you for your own good.
Right. Because, well, and if he doesn't steal that money, then somebody else is going to use it. And if we don't steal that money and use it for expanding Medicaid, then somehow you've ticked off God and Jesus and you're not going to get into heaven.
Yeah. Invoking God to defend your essentially what amounts to sticking a gun in your back and taking the contents of your wallet. I'm sorry, that cannot be. Thou shalt not steal is one of the top 10. And theft by government is still theft.
Yeah, indeed.
Exactly. We all know that taxes are necessary for the running of a government. I mean, let's be clear about that. You know, I'm not so anti-tax that I'm like, no, the Bible is clear. To whom you owe taxes, pay taxes. The problem is that when the government starts expanding into areas when it's no longer acting as the bearer of the sword for my good, but the bearer of the sword for the purpose of taking away from me for the good of someone else. No, that's my job to decide how I will distribute my my wealth to someone else. And frankly, it's very clear that there is a dichotomy. Study after study after study show that essentially the people of faith who understand that particular concept are bigger givers to charity than people who reject that concept in favor of the government being the safety net. And they don't think they have to give to charity because they already give through their taxes. And they're all for claiming that you don't give. And therefore, right. Need to take it away from you in the form of taxes. Are there skinflints out there who don't give money to charity? Of course there are. That's an absurd question.
Well, yeah, you're absolutely right, Chuck. And it's funny that you're mentioning that because as I sat here in my study recording this, I'm looking up on my bookshelf, and what's the first book that popped up in my vision?
Can I guess? Politics of Guilt and Pity.
No, not quite. Not quite. That one's off to my peripheral. But no, this is one by Arthur Brooks called Who Really Cares? It's an analysis by a sociologist who determined who actually was more charitable, and what he found out was conservative Christians are the most charitable folks out there, and that liberals, who want the government to pay for everything, are the least charitable. even whether it's a percentage of your income or just net giving.
Well, that's because they think they give through the auspices of government.
Through the auspices of government. Okay. And folks who would like to give know that they're being taken through the auspices of government and then don't have as much to give that they would like to give to worthy charities.
Okay.
You know, Chuck, you know I work with a lot of nonprofits, and always the refrain is, we just don't have enough resources to do X, Y, and Z, and they have to hold fundraisers and events and things and go beg the community for support. When liberal groups go and they just basically get a government grant, and that's mainly how they function, and they just go back to the government and talk about how, well, we need to redo it this way and reach all these people, which most of them never do. It's all taken up in administration. But, you know, the liberal groups think the government should pick our pockets. The conservative groups think that we should have more money in our pockets in order to give it voluntarily.
Bingo. And to the charity of our choice. I'm not saying they don't line up for grants, but what I'm saying is they'd much rather get their money from a parachurch organization. They'd much rather give their money direct from individuals, but they can't because the government has taken it all. And because of that, unfortunately, some of these groups are made complicit in the system. Because they have no choice. Otherwise, they cease to exist in the work that they would do. And I know you're involved in at least one of these groups that lives and dies by the federal grant and state grants. And yes, they have private fundraising efforts. I'm also sit on the board of a group that lives and dies by the grants that it gets. And there are a whole... as you and I discussed, there are groups that didn't get any federal grants at all because they supported traditional marriage.
Exactly. And you could see it. It's clearly a philosophical policy decision. You look at the list because funding comes out at the federal level at the end of September for the next fiscal year. Any group that touched on marriage strengthening and was conservative and had been funded under previous cycles, every last one of them were defunded. And where did that money go, Chuck? It went to state agency coffers, and it went to large groups like United Way and others.
And Medicaid expansion.
And Medicaid expansion. Exactly. Thank you very much.
And so, therefore, John Kasich is complicit in stealing money. Look, let's be clear about what the strategy is on the Medicaid expansion. It's vote buying. I gave you this stuff. If you want to continue getting this stuff, vote for me.
Well, that's a big part of it. Yes, Chuck, you're right. That's probably the immediate desire, but a larger desire is let's get so many people connected into government dependency
right.
When the system, which is designed to fail, starts failing, as we're starting to see now with Obamacare, we can build up the noise box for a single payer system run by the government, which has been the fait accompli end game of the Obama administration since the Affordable Care Act was first voted on without letting people read it.
And that is why I've been very reticent. I've noticed a lot of conservative sites sort of beating their breasts and saying, see, we told you so on the collapse of Obama exchanges. And I'm like, I said to myself, no, you don't understand. The next push will be, well, this was a bad idea. We tried to make it possible for private businesses to be involved. And we tried fascism. Now we have to go over to communism. In other words, we have to have the single party pair.
Yeah, that's exactly what
fascism didn't work in this case. We have to go to communism. So,
and ladies and gentlemen, that's why you need to start. You need to think through these things, the long term implications, because really, with the socialist / communist Marxist, it is the long march through the institutions, and your healthcare is the institution that they're marching through right now.
Exactly. And you know, this is not going to be the end of it, especially if who knows what's going to happen in 2016. So far, one of the main problems is nobody's talking, and none of the debates are covering this issue. And by the way, I want to go back real quick to this idea of the debate, since that's what we started with. Breitbart has an excellent article. I think everybody should read it. It's called "Last Night's Superb Debate Would Not Have Been Possible Without a GOP Revolt," and that's absolutely true. Because basically what we were getting was in a quote unquote debate was, well, so-and-so said this about you. What do you think about that? Well, so-and-so said this about you. What do you think of that? And it was basically, it was the old idea of on the playground where the guy stands in the middle and says, well, let's you and him fight. Basically throwing out fighting words and then expecting everybody to claw each other's eyes out over non-issues, really just junk stuff. He said this about you. He was mean. What do you say about that? And in fact, what we got was a far more substantive debate on Fox Business than had come previously. Certainly much better than that mess, the last debate that was done by who did that? That was
John Harwood.
CNBC.
CNBC. John Harwood.
And they that was just dismal. And what basically they said, okay, we're not going to play anymore, and we're certainly not going to go back to NBC. Listen, if this group that's here now, the combative group, and let me tell you, this is why Trump gets kudos. Because had he not been in the field, all the Republicans would have done was cower in the corner like a whipped yellow dog. And in fact, what they did was come out fighting and basically saying, no, ask me a real question. Come on, guys. Everybody's sick of this. And if Trump hadn't been there, I guarantee you the rest of the Republicans would have kowtowed. But they're not, because Trump is there, and Trump's willing to attack.
Indeed, that's right.
So I just wanted to get that in before, you know, as we were kind of, we weren't really off track, because let's face it, this particular issue has not been discussed. And what's going to happen with healthcare has not been discussed, and people are sort of being drawn off it. No, let's talk about what's going to happen to socialized healthcare. That needs to become a very important thing, because it's going to break companies. It's already breaking companies. And that's one thing these guys claim to be pro-business need to get through their heads.
Absolutely. You're right, Chuck. And we'll have another chance at hearing, hopefully, another substantive debate amongst these candidates, some of these candidates, hopefully, not all of them. Early next month, I believe it shifts to Nevada for another debate. And then we'll start, because late December's filing deadlines and early January starts the caucuses and the primaries. And it'll be interesting to see who's still standing come around Christmas time, actually after Thanksgiving. Let's see who's still standing, and see where we are with candidacies. Now, you and I both know that most likely all but maybe one of the undercard candidates will probably stick in until at least the first round of primaries and then start dropping out.
Yeah.
And on the top card, depending on the pressures that are put on them, I can see at least one, if not two, exiting early from that, maybe three if Rand Paul decides that he would rather run for his Senate seat and then run for the nomination. But so I think the next debate, we may have fewer people on stage, but we may get more substantive policy and less moaning and groaning about how much airtime they're getting or being petulant like a certain candidate from Ohio was.
Yeah. Well, that's it for today, Barry. We're out of time. And I think we sort of beat that up and let all the air out of it. So there will be more to discuss. And we want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.